views expressed on this program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of this station, its management, or other advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.
Get ready for a game changer. Sarah Westall is bringing you Business Game Changers Radio. Mondays at noon Pacific, 3 Eastern, Sarah will bring you leading experts, visionaries, and newsmakers who provide the best commentary on big issues and cutting-edge innovations. Sarah's 20 years as a business executive will help you think like an entrepreneur with expertise, energy, and attitude. Now here's your host, Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall, and you're listening to the Conscious Business Radio Network. Well, there's a lot of stuff going on in the Middle East, and unfortunately, let's face it, we're on the brink of World War III, and what the media isn't telling you is there is a huge exercise going on called Northern Thunder. And the exercise includes 350,000 soldiers, 20,000 tanks, 2,450 warplanes, and 460 military helicopters. And it's supplied by over 20 different countries that are involved in this exercise, from Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Bahrain, Qatar, United Arab Emirates. I mean, the list goes on and on. This does not include the United States. But it includes most of our, 20 countries in that area. While that is also going on, Turkey has been bombing Syria. They've been doing that since the beginning of February. And they've been urging the United States to mount a ground operation in Syria. They're trying to get their NATO allies to come together and do that. At the same time, Russia is warning everyone that an escalation such as this will cause World War III to explode in the region, which is a very scary thought. Some people believe, because they're trying to negotiate an agreement of peace, some people believe that this is really just all posturing on the side of NATO and the United States to force Russia to negotiate a deal. Some people think they're just going to call them their bluff and not do anything and see what happens. The scary part is it's a pretty dangerous chicken and egg scenario and to see what's going on. Well, this episode, I'm bringing Bruce Gagnon to the program, and it was initially intended to talk about militarizing space. And what ended up happening is, as we were talking about space, it just inevitably got into the what's going on in Syria and the buildup to war. And it's a very eye-opening conversation about what's going on. You know, space is now used as a way to dominate in war situations. And Bruce enlightens us on to what's going on. Now, everybody will have maybe their different opinion politically on things, but it's important for us to be educated and to know what's really going on in the world and militarily. And then from there, you can make up your own mind on how we should be proceeding with these things. But this is a very interesting conversation, and I hope you get a lot out of this interview that I have. Bruce has been an organizer for over 30 years, and he's a peace organizer. He has produced multiple documentaries, and he's appeared on 60 Minutes and in many publications around the world. He currently hosts his own TV show called The Issue, and it appears in Maine. And he has a weekly radio show that also airs in Maine. And we are going to welcome him right now to the program. Hi, Bruce. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Well, I know you're an expert at space issues and the military, and I'm going to dive right into this. What is the Outer Space Treaty?
It's a United Nations treaty, 1967, that said no country can put weapons of mass destruction in space, But more importantly, it said that all of the celestial bodies are the province of all humankind, and no country, no corporation, nor any individual can claim ownership of them. And it was really a very far-sighted treaty, because it anticipated that in the coming years, as the space age matured, that there would be desires to go out and essentially mine the sky. And they knew that, like when the Spanish and the Italians and the British all had their navies and they were competing for control of new parts of the world, right? Columbus is going out and all these other explorers. And that led to the global war system that we still suffer from today, as all these, at that time, European sea powers were competing with each other and cutting each other's throats so they can control resources and markets in the new worlds. And so the Outer Space Treaty is really that kind of visionary treaty, saying, let's be careful as we move off the planet, as we inevitably will, and let's don't make those same mistakes again and take the war system with us into space. It's what I call the bad seed of greed and corruption and domination.
Well, we have quite a developed war system, so which it would be. Well, so how I've read that you wrote an article on the fact that you think that this commercial space launch competitiveness act threatens that treaty. Why do you think that is such?
Well, one section of it states that U.S. citizens have rights to any resources that they extract from asteroids, moons, or other planetary bodies, including to possess, own, transport, use, and sell those resources. So this is really a shot across the bow of that United Nations treaty.
Well, if it goes against that treaty, then could it be deemed not valid, or are we just ignoring the treaty?
No, the United States is ignoring it, undermining it, and in fact, there's been a group of aerospace, a legal team, if you will, I've been tracking them for close to 20 years, who have been determined to essentially kill the Outer Space Treaty and the Moon Treaty that essentially says the same thing. There can be no military bases on the moon. Nobody can claim ownership of it. It belongs to everyone.
Well, do we have a military base on the moon, do you think?
I don't think so, but the Army back in the 50s was beginning to make plans to do such a thing, and then in the United States Congress, they commissioned a congressional study that was published in 1989 called America's Military Space Forces, the Next 50 Years. The Ford was signed by then Senator John Glenn, former astronaut, John Kasich, who's running for president today, then was a congressman from Ohio, Bill Nelson, who was then a congressman, now senator from Florida. He once went up on the space shuttle. And in this study, this congressional study, they talk about having bases on the moon, and they talk about having armed space stations controlling the Earth-Moon gravity well. If you think of a wishing well, you know, whoever's standing at the top of the well, if somebody's trying to get out of the well, you know, you kind of control their access. It's the same way with the Earth-Moon gravity well. Whoever controls the what they call the L4 and L5 positions, as well as the moon, controls who has access on and off the planet Earth. And in this study, they say, again, this is a congressional staffer writing this, endorsed by many people in Congress, it says our armed forces might lie in wait at that location to hijack rival shipments upon return. So the inference here is that if anyone is not us, anyone is from another country possibly, or from a competitor corporation, that our U.S. military would take them out, because we would be the masters of space, as they say at the U.S. Space Command and headquarters building in Colorado Springs, Colorado. On their doorway, they have their logo that reads Master of Space, and in a planning document called Vision for 2020, published in the late 90s, 1997. It said that the United States will control space and dominate space and deny access to space to other countries at various times.
So what was the initial intent of NASA? I mean, we kind of have to get into what all this and how it started and how we got to where we are now.
Well, NASA was, in its charter, it was created as a civilian agency. But from the very first days, we know that the early director of NASA was one of the former Nazi scientists that were building the V-1 and V-2 rockets for Hitler that he used to terrorize.
Von Braun?
Yeah, well, Von Braun, Kurt Debus, there were a whole bunch of them. But Kurt Debus, he became the first director of NASA. And so, anyway, from the very earliest days, there was a military oversight committee essentially appointed to control NASA. And so, from the beginning to the present moment, NASA's always been a stalking horse for the U.S. military development program for space warfare technology. And then, now today, everything they do at NASA, once told by Sean O'Keefe, a former director of NASA, a couple directors back, he said everything we do now is dual use, both military and civilian at the same time. So every time they fly any mission at NASA, it also has a military role where they're doing some kind of top secret military weapons research and development testing.
Well, what do you see the role of NASA to be versus the military? Because I had Gwen Shotwell on, who was the president of SpaceX a couple weeks ago, and she pretty much said that NASA's the science arm and of space, and military is the military arm of space, and the NASA's budget is significantly smaller than the military budget for space.
It's true that NASA's budget is significantly smaller, but again, one way the military augments its military space budget is by using NASA to do research and development projects for the Pentagon. So clearly, again, just listening to Sean O'Keefe, everything they do at NASA is dual use.
So basically, they figured out a way to increase their budget even more by saying, okay, this is all science-based. This is the stuff in the military that we're not too worried about having it be transparent, but we want you to work on this, and then everything else is moot.
It's not transparent.
Nothing
NASA
with NASA is transparent either?
No, I don't think NASA is transparent. They've done they do a lot of top secret launches. They do a lot of top secret investigations. It's long been known that on the space shuttle, there's top secret components of the space shuttle that are used to do military experiments. So, yeah, I mean, NASA is not transparent at all. I remember some years ago they launched a mission to go up and map to test the technology to map the surface of the moon, and we learned later that they were using it to create high-resolution three-dimensional maps of the Earth. They were creating that technology and then use that technology when the U.S. launched Shock and Awe of Iraq in 2003. And the guys driving around in Humvees breaking down doors in Baghdad, pulling people out of their homes in the middle of the night, they were hooked up to satellites that were using those three-dimensional maps that NASA had created, and that it was all top secret at the time. I'll never forget it.
Well, it makes sense. If you have satellite technology that can see close up, and we have the computing power that we have now, that they would do it, right? I mean, they're going to do all that stuff. But what doesn't make sense to me is how they don't have a – it would seem like they'd already have a base on the moon. It would seem like there'd be a lot more going on in space than we know about.
Right now, we can't even – the United States can't even get to the moon. NASA can't even get to the moon. They don't have the rocket launch technology to do it. In fact, the United States relies on Russia to get to the space station. In fact, the West has been demonizing Russia so badly in the last few years that Russia recently, about a year or so ago, I guess it was, announced that they were going to pull out of the space station in the next few years, and they suggested that the United States might want to get themselves a big trampoline in order to get to the space station in the future.
Well, but what does the military have as or do they solely use commercial and NASA rockets to get out to space?
The military?
Yeah.
Well, they, you know, they use commercial, I think mostly commercial rockets, sure. You know, Lockheed Martin and other such companies that are providing the launch capability for various launching of satellites and things like that.
What do you think is going on with all the spaceports being built all over the country? Right now we have 15 spaceports, and it looks like there's at least 10 more in plan.
Yeah, I mean, I think one motivation of it is to get the country addicted to spending on space. You know, just like almost every congressional district in the country has some component, manufacturing component of the military-industrial complex. So when you go in and try to cut the military budget, you can't do it politically because every single congressperson practically has, you know, an investment in their community. We've become addicted to war. Our economy has. Out of every discretionary tax dollar, about 55 cents now goes to the Pentagon. And so I think that that's part of the strategy, is to get the local economies connected to space spending. And then also I think it's a education and propaganda strategy. I'll never forget, I lived in Florida for 30 years, and this is where I got into the space issue. I now live in Maine, but I was at the Space Center one time, the tourist facility there at Kennedy Space Center, and they were going, I was at a conference actually there, and they were talking about their plan to totally renovate the entire Kennedy Space Center with a Mars theme. And one of the guy that was in charge of doing that renovation at KSC was talking about, you know, how many millions of children they have in the course of a year come through there. And he said, our goal is to get them to support everything space, and particularly everything Mars, so that we can, that next generation, get them sold on, you know, kicking their tax dollars down this road for Mars, and which clearly is going to benefit the corporations that are wanting to get out to Mars. And it's a big expensive operation to try to, you know, go all the way to Mars, you know, on a continual basis.
Do you think there's any benefit for just humans in general, for us getting to be able to live on other planets and things?
Well, you know, I've had a lot of discussions with people over the years about that very thing. I'm not particularly opposed to going out into space, but I do think that, you know, I'll never forget one time I was on a speaking tour in Southern California, and I picked up the Los Angeles Times, and I was reading a story quoting the Mars Society, who said, quote, "The Earth is a rotting, stinking, dying planet." And I was offended by that.
Well, it's still a lot better than what Mars is right now.
say that again?
I said we're still in a better shape here on Earth than what Mars has right now.
Well, yeah, exactly. And I personally think this is a beautiful planet. I love the color, the fragrance. Certainly, we do have pollution problems. The Pentagon's the largest contributor to climate change on the planet, has the largest carbon footprint of any other institution on the planet, was excluded from the Kyoto Protocols. The United States wouldn't sign them unless the Pentagon and its footprint were excluded. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think there's a lot we can do on this planet to clean it up and take good care of it and learn to live properly before we go careening off into space, again, carrying that bad seed. See, I think we're very immature species. And that if we do go careening off into, you know, to Mars and the moon and all these other places, the way we presently think, you know, with this war system and the ecological disasters, you know, we're creating all this space junk orbiting the planet. Years ago, I organized a protest at the Space Center, and Edgar Mitchell, one of the Apollo astronauts, he's the only former astronaut to ever come to one of our protests there at the Space Center, and he spoke out strongly about his concern about space junk, saying that it's so bad now, you know, we have to move a space station to another orbit because they're tracking space junk that's coming dangerously close. And but he went on to say, you know, that we blow up somebody's satellite, we knock out some country's satellite with anti-satellite weapons, and we're going to create enough space junk additionally up there that we're going to be entombed to the planet. We're not going to be able to get off this Earth. So I say to all my friends and people that I meet that are, you know, really itching to get out into space, you know, you better start thinking about, you know, our environmental impact in our own orbit. You know, we've got to begin to have a whole new consciousness about space, that it's not,
we just have to be smart, right? I mean, that it's just stupid. if you're going to kill yourself, if there's junk in the way and you're going to die trying to get out, or you just can't, you can't have anything orbiting, you can't have a space station because we got too much junk there, it's dumb. So why do dumb things? And let's try to be smarter.
Well, and that's what we keep doing, though. You know, we keep doing stupid things. We're in a cycle of perpetual war right now. You know,
well, that's pretty dumb too.
So, you know, that's why I'm saying that my ultimate point is, until we become a little wiser, until we become a little more reflective, I don't think we're ready. We're like, you know, teenagers that want to drive our daddy's car, but, you know, we're not, we haven't even learned to drive yet, you know.
We sneak out of the house and drive the car.
and wrap it around a telephone pole. And so that's, I believe, my humble opinion, that this is the way, the kind of consciousness we would be carrying with us as we go off into space at this time. And so that's why I've always been interested in the work of our organization, the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space, because we're trying to create a global discussion, a global debate, a global consciousness raising about what kind of seed should we carry with us when we inevitably do move out deep into deeper space.
Well, moving out into space is actually kind of a wise thing to do, too, when you think about it, because we, with having nuclear weapons and so many people having it, it's just almost a mathematical certainty that at some point a nuclear weapon's going to go off and that somebody's going to use it, right? That's a sad thing to think about, but it really is true. You know, you get so many people and so much time goes by, some idiot at some point is going to use it. And just for our own protection, to be able to live on other planets is probably a smart move.
Well, you know, I figure I'm 64 now. I've been working on space issues for about 35 years. I don't think I'm likely to go off into space. But I do think that I might be able to use my life to try to prevent everything that you just said might, well, in fact, you didn't say it might happen. You said it probably will happen.
At some point.
I'm trying to make sure that it doesn't. Although I will tell you, one time I showed up at a protest at the Space Center wearing a NASA flight suit someone got a hold of and gave me, and I got up on the stage and announced that NASA had started a contest to have the first activist in space, and that I had applied and been accepted, and that in fact I had won the contest, but there was only one downside. It was only a one-way flight.
They want to ship you out of here.
And so some people believed me, actually. Some they didn't realize I was just joking. But
well, I'm sure if you're talking against what NASA's doing, they probably don't like you very much. But, you know, I think it's important that we look at all sides of the issues, right? I mean, to be conscious about it, that's why our government was founded, with balance of powers, so that we can objectively look at the serious issues. I like the idea of venturing into space. I think there's some fun and exciting things we can do, but the same standpoint, I think we just need to be smart. You know what I mean?
But can we really afford it right now? I mean, we can't even feed our own people on this planet in a proper way. We can't deliver health care to people in a proper way. We've got this massive problem of climate change coming at us. And so should we be taking all that money that, if we collectively used all those resources, we could actually solve all these problems? You know, the aerospace industry has been bragging for years that Star Wars will be the largest industrial project in the history of the planet Earth. And one time I was reading in my subscription to Space News, in the editorial section, they had an editorial where they said they've solved the problem. They said, you know, we've got to be responsible corporate citizens, meaning the aerospace industry, and come up with a dedicated funding source. And we have. And they said, we're now sending our lobbyists to Washington to secure it. And you know what it was?
What?
The entitlement programs, which officially in America are Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and what's left of the welfare program after Bill Clinton got finished with it. So these are the programs that the aerospace industry has targeted for defunding in order to pay for everything space. Well, I have a problem with that, okay?
Well, I think that if you just take a significant portion of, I mean, we spend so much on the military all over the world. If you just cut that back by 10%, we could solve a lot of our hunger issues. We could solve, there's so many things that we could solve if we didn't spend it all on the military. We're so much, how many bases do we have around the world?
Almost 1,000.
How many bases does other countries?
Professor David Vine from American University has just come out with a book called Base Nation, where he says we have 1,000 bases. I know that Russia has 2 or 3 that I'm aware of, one in Syria, one in the stands. I forget which stand, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, I'm not sure which, but one there, one in Syria. That's 2 that I know of. They might have one somewhere else. China don't have any formally, although recently they've been building a couple of these little reef bases out there in the Pacific Ocean because they import 80% of their oil on ships, and under the Obama pivot to Asia Pacific, we're moving 60% of our military forces in the Asia Pacific, including a massive naval buildup, building new bases in places like Jeju Island and Korea on a pristine 500-year-old fishing and farming community that are being torn apart for this new base for U.S. warships so that we can have the potential to interdict China's importation. So China's responded by starting to build these couple reef bases. So China might have 2-3 bases now outside of their, you know, their own country. But outside of them, that's it. You know, we're surrounding Russia and China like crazy today and using space technology to do it. This so-called missile defense program, which has nothing to do with defense. It's a key part of U.S. first strike attack planning. We're surrounding both Russia and China with ground-based and sea-based missile defense systems. In fact, for many years, I've been reading about it in Aviation Week and Space Technology magazine, the U.S. has been practicing Space Command has been having an annual space war game they call 2017, where they launch a first strike attack on Russia and China, and then when they try to respond after they've been hit by the U.S. first strike attack, they try to launch whatever retaliatory nuclear capability they have left, and that it is then that these so-called missile defense systems based on Navy Aegis destroyers and Patriot, now THAAD, these ground-based missile defense systems, they're going into all these countries surrounding both Russia and China. They try to pick off that retaliatory strike by Russia or China, giving the U.S. a quote-unquote successful first strike attack. So all this is coordinated by U.S. military satellites, U.S. military ground downlink stations, radars all over the planet. I just did a speaking tour in November. I went to England, where I went to 3 U.S. downlink stations that are all hooked up to the U.S. missile defense program, one near Oxford and 2 up in Yorkshire. And the peace movement there in England is very much opposed. They organize protests and everything else against these bases. They don't want their country to be used as a relay station, essentially, for the U.S. first strike attack program. So it's all run through space technology.
Well, So we completely dominate the world in military. I mean, obviously, we have 1,000 bases all over the world, and now we're working to dominate space. And I think there's a way to be more frugal with that so we can solve other problems. But we've made a decision as a country that this is, well, what our economy is going to be. But I want you to, I want to ask this question. Why is it dangerous versus safer for the United States to be the complete sole dominant power everywhere?
Well, number one, right now, militarily, we are. There's no doubt about it. But why it's so dangerous is because other countries aren't going to stand for it. We, presently, we have what's called a unipolar world. One country, us, both economically and militarily, controlling the planet. And other countries aren't going to like that. They don't like it. Russia, China, and other countries as well. And so already they're starting to react. Russia and China are increasing their spending on military space applications in order that they cannot allow the U.S. to control the planet, because all warfare on the planet today is controlled by military satellites, by U.S. Military space technology. When Bush launched the Shock and Awe attack in Iraq in 2003, in the initial attack, 70% of the weapons that were used were directed to their targets by military satellites. So we, in the global network, we call military satellites the triggers for war, because without them, the United States can't do anything anymore.
Well, why is Syria going on forever? What's really going on there? Why, if we have so much power and we can dominate everything from space and everything else is, I mean, they essentially have nothing compared to us. Why are we struggling? Why is this lasting forever? And why, I mean, what's really going on?
Well, the bottom line is what's the reason why Syria is still, the reason why Assad hasn't been toppled. We're talking about the United States, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Israel. They want to topple Assad. Saudi Arabia and Turkey have been funding and directing ISIS with the help of the United States for years. It's now very well proven that this is so. And so the U.S., you know, the U.S. has been bombing, supposedly bombing ISIS for years, right? But nothing ever happened, right? They just got stronger and stronger. And now Russia goes into Syria because they're long allies with Syria. And they want to...
And they have a base there, right?
They do have a base there. And they, all of a sudden, what has it been? Maybe 6 months that Russia's been in there bombing now, and all of a sudden, the Syrian forces are, now they're moving all the way up to Aleppo now. They're, you know, they're winning. And so just today, we're seeing Turkey and Saudi Arabia begging the United States to join them in a ground assault into Syria.
Why do we care about Syria? What is the big deal?
It's a big story. It's the biggest story of our time, the biggest story of our life right now.
Well, I know, but nobody talks about it except alternative media sites, and the regular media just talks about, they'll talk about ISIS and stuff, but nobody really gets to the why, the real why.
Did you ever see that YouTube video? If you just Google, General, former NATO commander, and ran for president.
Saw that. All the different countries were going to go attack.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, I saw that.
What I'm talking about, right?
Yeah.
What's his name? I can't think of his name offhand. But anyway, he said in that expose that we want to take out Iraq, we want to take out Libya, you know, Afghanistan, and then he mentioned Syria. Iran. You mentioned Iran.
And I remember him saying, well, why? And the guy goes, I don't know.
that's where he let us down, because he did know. And let me.
I want to know.
I'm going to tell you. It might sound heavy to you, but hold on for the ride. Give me a little bit of time so I can tell the whole story. I watched a YouTube video last year of George Friedman, who's the CEO of Stratfor, 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 which is the sort of the privatized CIA. A lot of corporations go to Stratfor for intelligence information. So George Friedman's the founder and CEO of Stratfor. He was making a speech in Chicago, and he lays out the need to have regime change in Moscow and Beijing. Okay. Now, why, God knows why, would the United States want to try to take down Moscow and Beijing? Can you imagine? I mean, you're talking World War III,
yeah, that's
right?
That's a big thing.
All right. Why would you do that? I mean, it's crazy. But don't we know by now, this is just my opinion, educated opinion, I think, don't we know by now that the number one job of the Pentagon is to serve as the primary resource extraction service for corporate interests, for corporate globalization? And so we see Libya recently taken out, that has the largest supply of oil on the African continent.
They also didn't have a World Bank there as well, which maybe that could be it, because that's the first thing they did.
They had a state-run bank. You're exactly right. And then beyond that, we've, you know, Iraq, and, you know, you go through all these places, and as the old saying was during George Herbert Walker Bush's presidency, we wouldn't be bombing Iraq if their biggest export product was broccoli, you know. Okay, so what does Russia have that we would want, right? Besides being a huge country, they happen to have the world's largest supply of natural gas, and they also have, of course, significant supplies of oil. But there's something even more, even bigger. Look at a map, and look at the Arctic Ocean. And as the Arctic melts because of climate change, and now you can get in there and drill, baby, drill into the Arctic, which country on the planet has the largest land border with the Arctic Ocean? And so basically what Stratfor and people in other places are saying is we've got to balkanize Russia, break it up into constituent pieces so that the oil corporations would have an easier chance to have access and to control the whole Arctic drilling operation. It's massive, massive amount of, you know, money to be made there. That's one reason I believe that the oil industry is working so hard to fund the climate change deniers to keep that whole movement going, because they really don't want to deal with this climate change thing because it's, you know, big profits to be made at the end of the line.
Well, there's profit on both sides of the climate change issue. You know what I mean? You can argue. I'm just saying that to keep that debate going regardless is a good thing from a commercial standpoint.
Well, you know, but anyway.
I know that's a disappointing commentary. I know that, but it's...
I got another piece to it.
I want
to
hear more.
It's BRICS. You probably know about BRICS.
Yep.
BRICS.
But maybe our listeners
But a lot of people don't know about BRICS. BRICS stands for Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa. They have said, we don't like the IMF and the World Bank. They exploit countries. They force you to privatize your resources. They force you into austerity budgets in order to pay back loans. They exploit you. They hurt your national economy, and they hurt your people. And they essentially destabilize your national sovereignty. And so we're going to create our own development bank to rival the IMF and the World Bank. We're not going to exploit people the way they do. And they've created BRICS. And so they put in hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars into the beginning development account. Now a lot of other countries are wanting to join BRICS, and they want to be a part of it. And this is scaring the living hell out of the Western capitalist countries who have had, for a long time, control of the global economy. And they're not happy about this.
Well, I had Irvin Goldman, who used to be responsible for strategy for J.P. Morgan, on, and I asked him this. And he said that he sees it as a three-tier competition going on for control of global finance. You have the China, Russia, you know, the BRIC country thing. And then you have the European Union, and then you have the United States. He thinks it's like a three-tier competition. Is that
well,
what
I
you see?
I see the European Union as being subservient to the U.S.
So you see it as more of a two-tier a two-pronged deal.
Yeah. And so what BRICS is calling for is a multipolar world. No one country is in control of the planet. No one country is militarily in control of the planet. No one country, always meaning the U.S., of course, no one country is in charge of the global economy. That it's shared amongst all the people, all the countries, a multipolar world, and which will be a more peaceful world because we won't be cutting each other's throats so much. That's the dream they're trying to lead us towards. And now recently you've begun to see that Russia and China are announcing that they're going to trade oil using their native currencies rather than using the petrodollar. And of course, this is really freaking the United States out. And so this is coming back to your question of Syria. Syria is a linchpin as far as Russia is concerned. And I've been studying on this for 2 years straight, so I really can get a handle on it. Russia says that if Syria falls, then the next step they're going to take out Iran. And then after that, it's easy for them to take out Russia. And so Russia feels like it has to defend themselves in Syria. And what the United States and NATO are doing is that, and it's, again, clear in my mind, I'm absolutely convinced now that the U.S. is involved with Saudi Arabia and Turkey in funding and directing ISIS, and that the U.S. has been sending these kind of Islamic fundamentalist forces into countries. We recently have seen that the United States has been sending these Islamicists into Ukraine to fight against the people in the Donbass in the eastern Ukraine, the Russian-speaking citizens that are being attacked by the neo-Nazis out of Kiev that were essentially handed the country after the U.S. facilitated special emphasis on the word facilitated coup d'etat there in Ukraine. The goal of the United States is to create chaos on the Russian border as a way to begin to break it up. And so they want to send in these Islamicist fighters into Chechnya and to other countries along the Russian Federation, along the borders, in order to destabilize Russia, to force them to spend a lot of money, a lot of military. That further allows the Western media to demonize Putin, you know, and blah, 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 on down the road to justify continued NATO expansion into Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, Romania, Bulgaria, Poland. I mean, you know, at the time of the fall of the former Soviet Union, Gorbachev, meeting with then U.S. Secretary of State Jim Baker, said, I'm worried about, you know, if we pull back the Warsaw Pact, you know, we shut down the Warsaw Pact, pull back, you know, our militaries. I'm scared about NATO expansion up to our country. And he was promised NATO would not expand one centimeter. Well, guess what? That promise was broken by the United States repeatedly. Every president since then, and the United States is now sitting right on the Russian border in many different countries, with major NATO operations and just, you know, provoking the hell out of Russia. Now just turn it the other way. Cuban Missile Crisis in reverse. What if Russia?
Oh, yeah. We would go ballistic if this was happening in the
Thank
other direction.
You in Canada and Mexico, right?
Well, we would just be crazy. Now, but what I don't understand is why would we provoke China when we depend on China so much for so many things?
We're their biggest customer.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Even, you know, all the rare earth materials and things, we are not that safe by, you know, isolating China and getting, if we piss them off too much, we could be in trouble. I mean, just they have so much control over specific elements of our economy that I don't understand why we aren't smarter on that.
Well, you know, a lot of people, including my partner, ask me that question all the time. And I say to her repeatedly, you're thinking too rationally. You're thinking rationally because you're a rational, sensible person. The people running our country, what I call the corporate criminal syndicate, are basically irrational. They are greedy. They are crazy. They are warlike. I mean, don't we know that by now? And they roll the dice. They're like a gambler out of control in Las Vegas, just rolling the dice until somebody stops them.
Yeah, but China can just step up and, I mean, so what do you think the end game will be? Because
The end game is now underway. China is saying, we're vulnerable. Our shipping lanes are now vulnerable to import our oil. And so they're now working with Russia to build a pipeline across that huge expanse of both Russia and China. I mean, imagine that project, would you? Just look at the map. But it would be more secure than giving the United States the ability to choke off the importation of their oil. It would be like putting a loaded gun to their head, you know.
So China's going to support Russia no matter what, right? I mean, China and Russia are allies. Or do we think, I mean, if we're going to try to take over China too, they're going to be allies for sure. So do you foresee China not defending Russia? Because I think that's the only way this would ever.
No, they understand what's going on.
Okay, so do you think they're rational over there? Are they rational, or is China rational, or do you think China will be irrational?
I don't think either Russia. Well, let's just play with some numbers for a minute, okay? The Stockholm Institute for, I forgot what it's called, SIPRI, Stockholm Peace Research Institute, every year puts out the global totals on military spending, okay? So last year, when you add up the whole world, who spent what on the military? The U.S. is leader of the pack at 34%, okay? You add up all the NATO allies to that, they come in at over 50. To the U.S. number, you come in at over 50%. Russia, 4.8%. China, 12%. Okay? So you got U.S. and NATO allies well over 50%. You got Russia at 4.8%, China at 12%. That's 17%. Who's the real threat here in the world?
Well, we're a threat militarily, but China has a threat business-wise. I mean, they can hold back resources, and we won't. I mean, they have
but
our.
It's
computing.
Not in China's interest to crash their own economy. If China, you know, they hold a lot of our debt, right? China doesn't want to see the United States economy implode, because what happens?
Exactly.
They got a lot of people that are out of work. And they got domestic problems and at home, right?
Yeah, well, they're just kind of walking a tightrope. They don't really probably – it's a very difficult situation. They don't know what to do. Well, I'm sure they don't really know what to do.
But in the meantime, China knows they're dealing with a very irrational player, U.S. and NATO, a warlike alliance. And excuse me for saying it, but I'm going to tell you that what I really think and feel here – there was a guy named Bertram Gross, college professor years ago, that wrote a book called Friendly Fascism. And he reminded us that what Mussolini's definition of fascism was. It was the wedding of corporations and government. It's my contention that our government in the United States of America is controlled by corporations. They control the country. They control the Congress. They control the presidency. They control the courts.
I would say that's true.
They're big corporate money. And so what we now have, that's why I call it a corporate criminal syndicate. We don't have a democracy in America. We have an oligarchy. Oligarchy is defined as control of the many by the few. That's what we have today in this country.
The corporations are controlling the government.
Yeah, and because of what was the name of the Supreme Court decision that, you know, said you can spend money.
Oh, yeah, the PACs, super PACs. Yeah. Yeah, that changed politics significantly.
Yeah. So that's where we're at. And so, so China and Russia, look out. You know, they're not communist countries anymore. They're capitalist countries. They are. There's no doubt about it. But they are, I will say this, it's my opinion for what it's worth. I think they are trying to take care of their people in a better way than we do. You know, we're dog eat dog, every man for himself, you know, the hell with you and everybody else. And at least I think they're trying to use the resources of their country to to look out for one another. There's still an ethic of that in the world.
Although they have issues too, because China does some pretty gruesome things to their own people.
Well, you know, they got their problems, but they do.
We have more people in jail. We
got more people in jail than anybody else in the world.
When you start talking about, you know, the fact of all the ugly things they do in China, you know, where they sell body parts and things, then I think, well, you know, that's awful. But then when you look at our percentages of people in our prison system, it's like, well, gosh, they don't have hardly any percentage of people wise, we are way over the top.
And look how many of those people are now. You got to go see this new Michael Moore movie because he talks about all of this. Who do we invade next? I saw it yesterday. It's quite a brilliant film. But he talked about this whole prison slave labor now. You know, you got all these young black people in jail in 35 states. When they get out of prison, they can't vote. They're essentially, slaves anymore. But people are working for pennies an hour in the prisons, doing all kinds of corporate work, right? So the corporations, that's slave labor, you know, by any definition of the word.
There's a left-right coalition going on in this country, and I don't think people realize, you know, how strong that coalition really is. And it'll be interesting to see how things develop, because there really is a left-right coalition. They obviously have their differences, a lot of differences, but there's a coalition when it comes to this part. People don't like to see corporations abusing people, or bottom line, they don't like to see our government not being used for the purpose that it was intended to be used for. And for the regular person to be thrown out as not important for the sake of, you know, special interests and a smaller amount of people. And that's where the left-right coalition, I think, is coming together for our country. But, you know, I have a question for you, which is kind of a curveball. So much of our world finance happens in the city of London, which is part of London. They pretty much are the financial, you know, control of the world. And they joined the BRIC countries with that World Bank that they put together. England did. Where does that come in?
Well, I think they've asked. I don't know that they've actually been accepted, but I believe they have asked. Where does that come in? I think it's a strategy to try to stay relevant, okay? You know, try to stay in control, keep your fingers in the pie. I think Russia and China are smart enough to know how to play play that one.
Yeah, because the city of London, it's like Washington, D.C. They have their own rules. They don't follow the same laws and rules of the country. They make their own. And everything gets done through the city of London when it comes to finance. I shouldn't say everything. A significant portion of things get done.
Yeah, and apparently I once read, I don't know how true this is, I won't swear to it, but I will say that I believe it, that the Queen owns a lot of America. I mean, you know, she's got massive investments in our country. So clearly London owns a lot of the world. So I think you're right about that.
Well, but you know, it's interesting. I just read this morning that Russia actually owns a spaceport in our country.
Really? Which one is that?
I read it on, I'll send you the link, and I'll actually put that link up on the site when I put the show up. But they own one of our spaceports, which I think is interesting. And China owns a lot of our country.
Yeah. It's becoming, you know, an interlocked planet. You know, when I look at the picture of the planet, you know, I never see flags and boundary lines, you know, between places. You know, I don't see, oh, that person's an Eskimo and that person's a Russian and, you know, that's an American. I just see this orb. You want to talk about space, you want to talk about space travel. We are traveling in space. We're on a little spaceship, little planet Earth, flying through space. And you want to talk about, you know, going inhabiting other countries. Hell, other planets, rather. We can't even handle this one, let alone move somewhere else.
But we might
else.
Need to, just to keep our human species alive. Yeah. I mean, maybe we need to.
I imagine the animal and plant world would be glad to see us go the way we're treating them these days. But, you know, I kind of grew up believing in Native American spirituality. And so, you know, I see the way I see the, you know, life and everything is that all of us are connected, you know, the plants, the animals, the water, the air. We're all relatives. We're all connected to each other. And so it's not so much about, oh, let's just get the hell out of here and leave all this behind. Well, these are our relatives. This is our Mother Earth. You know, we have a responsibility to each other. And with the word other having a broad, broad definition. You know, so that's the way I try to use my life and view my life. Could I make a plug for my website and blog?
Oh, absolutely. I have a few more questions I want to ask you, and then definitely plug it right now. Go ahead.
Well, our website, the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space, we were created in 1992. Our website is spaceforpeace.org, spaceforpeace.org. And I invite you to follow me on my blog. I blog every day. I post videos. I write things on my travels. I put reports up there. It's called Organizing Notes. Organizing Notes. You can just Google that along with my name, Bruce Gagnon, and find it very easily.
Well, that's great. And I'll have that information up on my radio page as well. And I'll mention it again when we go into podcast so that people can, you know, they'll be able to get it as well. But a question for you. I have a couple more questions. When it comes to space, are there alliances with other countries, or do you think the United States is completely on its own when it does all this military stuff? Is it a global alliance?
The U.S. has minions, you know. They have vassals. They have client states that they control. So clearly, you know, they have partners, but they're junior partners. And that's the way the U.S. does things. And anybody that tries to be an equal partner, their leadership gets taken down and taken out. That's just the way the U.S. plays ball.
Well, how does the U.S. view China recently going to the moon?
As a competitor, and as a competitor, someone to be worried about, and that's why the United States is working through various color revolutions in Hong Kong and places like that to try to overthrow the government in Beijing, just like the U.S. is trying to do the same in Moscow by overthrowing the current government of Russia by having color revolutions in places like Georgia and places like Ukraine and other such places that border Russia. The U.S. is a control freak and wants to control everything.
Well, how much funding do you think we put towards space? How much is we know we have a huge black budget. How much do you think, see, I don't believe the black budget is completely known. I think there's a lot of money that's funneled from different agencies into the black budget. How much?
And the Congress doesn't even know what the black budget is. They're not even allowed to know.
Exactly. And if you think about it, we audited the Federal Reserve and there was trillions going to different banks and things. And then also the exchange fund that we have, we've never audited that. So how much do you think we're really funneling to militarizing space that's part of the black budget that we just don't even know about?
I would say, you know, a probably low estimate would be hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars, if not a couple trillion dollars over the years. But, you know, what's more interesting to me is where did the black budget come from? Do you know? Do you know where the whole architecture of the black budget came from?
No. Where did it come from?
There was a reporter at Jane's Defense Weekly, you know, one of the primary aerospace industry magazines out of Great Britain. And he wrote a book, and he did a whole research, years of research, to find out where it came from. And he came to the conclusion that it came from the Nazis that were brought to the United States following the end of World War II under the program called Operation Paperclip. So it was more than 1,500 Nazi operatives, the guys that were doing the mind control experiments with Jewish prisoners and French prisoners of war. They were, you know, doing all kinds of experimentation on them. They were brought to the U.S. and they created the MK Ultra mind control experiments back in the 60s when people were jumping out of windows because of bad trips with LSD. These were the former Nazi scientists that were doing these experiments. The flight medicine team for Hitler that were putting Jews and other prisoners in freezing temperatures to see how the body would react. They were brought to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio to create the U.S. flight medicine program. Wernher von Braun and his brother and Kurt Debus and Arthur Rudolph, a whole series of these engineers and scientists that were doing the Nazi rocket program were brought to the U.S. to create the U.S. space program. A guy by the name of Reinhard Gehlen, Hitler's man in charge of Nazi intelligence, was brought to the U.S. under Operation Paperclip. And after the war, now imagine this, after the war, the head of Nazi intelligence was sent back to the new country, West Germany, and put in charge of West German's intelligence operation. And so he had this, what he called a rat line, of all these anti-communist operatives in all of these countries throughout Europe, and they were immediately put to work trying to take down the former Soviet Union at the end of World War II. This essentially is what created the Cold War. Really a fascinating book about this whole thing.
Interesting.
I'm almost finished reading it now. I highly recommend it to people. It's an education that you will never forget. It's called The Devil's Chessboard. Alan Dulles, The CIA and the Rise of America's Secret Government by David Talbot. But unbelievable. Make your hair stand up.
To really see what was really going on.
And what is still going on.
But it wasn't that clean anyways, because we were on the side of the Soviet Union fighting the Germans, but the Soviet Union, Russia and Soviet Union, they were pretty, they were doing more. They were killing more people than the Nazis were.
I'd be careful about that.
That's not true.
And one of the things you learn in this book is that Alan Dulles, who ended up heading up the CIA, one of the first things he did after the end of World War II, when the Cold War started, he sent this really unsuspecting Quaker peace activist guy into the Eastern Europe, where he was quickly apprehended by Soviet people, and then he sent his family in there as well, and Dulles created these rumors that this guy was a double, you know, that he was an agent for the CIA, and so Stalin freaked out. Because Stalin, you know, this is just after the war is over.
Well, Stalin wasn't a nice guy.
Let me finish.
Okay.
Soviet Union lost 27 million people in World War II.
Yeah.
The United States lost 500,000.
Yes.
And they were totally paranoid, okay, that they were going to get attacked again right away. They were trying to rebuild, you know, recover. They built this big wall, you know the story.
Yes.
And so now Dulles is creating this series of unsuspecting Quakers that are being accused of being, you know, that are being set up as being CIA people by the CIA in order to freak Stalin out. Stalin freaks out and begins to overreact, and that's when he started rounding up people, sending them Siberia and everything else. And Dulles and them were laughing, saying, he bit. He took the bait. We set him up, and then of course they began demonizing him and everything else. And then he really went crazy with it. And yes, he killed a lot of people. There's no doubt about it.
You can't excuse the behavior, but we tried to instigate him to do that.
Exactly.
That's awful. Well, that's what I'm saying. There's just so many shades of gray when it comes to war. War is such an awful thing, and And who's the good guy and who's the bad guy is really hard to determine when you start digging into all this stuff. It's really ugly.
That's why we have to be careful about this American exceptionalism talk, you know, that we're the greatest country on the planet, we're exceptional people, you know, blah, 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 and everything else, because it's all a myth, and our hands are so dirty. And this is why people around the world know all these stories. They know it because they lived through it, and that's why they hate us so much.
Well, and I think the average person really isn't a bad person. They just are ignorant to what's going on. I really think they think that we have higher morals as a country, and we go and we do good around the world. I think
we care about human life more than they do.
Yeah, right? I really think that's what people think.
Yeah, of course. And you're right. You're right. American people aren't bad people. They're just highly ignorant when it comes. They're not stupid, but they're politically ignorant, politically unsophisticated.
But it's not their fault necessarily, because the media is so blacked out.
That's right. And, you know, Noam Chomsky talks about this a lot. He says, how do you expect the American people to react to something they don't know anything about? Okay. And that's really the truth. And so that's why I feel that it's my job to spend my life doing what I can in my own limited way to try to help people come alive, wake up from this slumber, wake up from these illusions. You know, we always used to brag about, you know, we're so democratic and we're so free. Look at those poor Soviet slobs, you know, totally under the control of Pravda and everything else, you know. When you think we get the real story in the New York Times and the Washington Post? Forget about it.
Oh, no. Well, I think the internet is an amazing tool. I do think we're in a new renaissance in so many different ways. And where it's going to end up is going to be, you know, the big question. I suppose it'll always be fluid, but it's just, it's amazing. And I think the media is being challenged. I think everything's being challenged right now. People are restructuring their paradigms.
Yeah. Well, you know, can I tell you one more story?
Yeah, I'd love it to hear it.
Okay. Recently there was a German editor of a major newspaper, and he was dying of cancer. And so he wrote a book where he said, I've been a CIA operative for years. They would hand me a story. I would publish it with my name on it. And he told the whole story. It became a bestseller in Germany. This was last year, last year and a half ago. And his newspaper then had to lay off like more than 100 people because people started canceling their subscription like crazy. And it created this whole chain reaction in Germany where several papers just almost, you know, either went out of business or, you know, are hanging on by their fingernails.
Because nobody believed them anymore.
Exactly. Exactly. And so I think you're absolutely right. People are getting smart and saying, I got to go learn for myself what's going on. I got to go figure it out. That's what I do all day long.
But it's hard because I do the same thing, but it's really hard to figure out what sources you can trust and ones you can't. And even the ones you think you can trust, they're going to get infiltrated and get some bad information too. But, you know, I suppose.
So you got to check, you got to double check, you got to triple check, you know. All that kind of thing. I have a question for you, Sarah.
Yes.
How did you know to call me? I'm surprised because looking at the kind of people you interview, I'm surprised that you would interview me.
I look for educated people on subjects. I want the best people I can find, period. I don't care where they come. I just want the people that can come on and really educate us. I want to get to the meat of the stories. And I don't have a political agenda. As you can tell, I'm not really far right or far left. I try to look at all sides of the story, but I want people who really have been there and who are really trying to figure stuff up. I look for leaders in business, which you see, I have a lot of leaders in business, and I look for leaders everywhere. And I saw you talk on some YouTube stuff. I'm always watching and reading. And so when I find somebody that I think is very educated and spent a lot of time researching, those are the kind of people I want on the show. Also, people who are leaders in different business areas because they are right in the middle of it too. So they know what's really going on. you know, people are going to have their agendas and they're going to present things in different ways. But you can get information by talking to the frontline people. And that's what I'm looking for.
Yeah, well, that's good. I really appreciate you having me on. Thank you.
Yeah,
I think you've been more than fair to me.
Yeah, I'm not going to rip you apart for. I mean, you have a pretty, you know, you're peace. You're into the peace movement, and I see benefits of going into space and different things. But all the issues that you're bringing up, they're real issues, and we need to be able to think and do these things and look at it. If we're really going to spend money on the military, then we need to be looking at, we need to have the station I'm part of is Conscious Business. And if we're really going to be a conscious business entity, we have to look at these things. Right? I mean, we can't shut out voices that's like putting your head in the sand. But I have one more question for you, two more questions, and these are, you know, they're at the bottom, what I wanted to finish with. But do you think the military has technology that's using that, for example, other forms of energy or other technology that we haven't been exposed to that could really help human beings?
You know, I don't have any personal proof of any of that, but I think it's highly likely that there's a lot going on that we don't know about and that they're keeping, you know, secret. So I think it's highly likely, but, you know, the whole Tesla stuff, you know, and technologies that would essentially give us free energy, I think those things are out there, but they keep it buried because the corporate interests are making a lot of money, but keeping us, you know, like a heroin addiction, you know, addicted to oil. And
well, I think oil is such a big backbone to everything that's going on geopolitically and to our money supply that would throw such a wrench in the power structure that they don't want to go there.
Yeah.
But where do you see the future of this entire situation? I mean, we talked about a lot. We didn't just talk about space, you know, military in space. We kind of got to everything. But where do you see kind of the future of our planet and where is it going?
Well, we're either going to collapse and our species will die off on this planet, just a few years because of climate change. In a few years, 20, 30, 40, 50 years, you know, that kind of thing. It's moving quicker than everybody anticipated.
Well, there's a huge group that's against, you know, that just says the whole climate change is bogus and that it's really insignificant in history what we're really doing to the planet. What do you have to say to that?
I think that the evidence is overwhelming. But you know what? I live in Maine, and I can tell you, I've been living in Maine now for 13 years, and I've seen the difference here in Maine in the 13 years since I moved here. When I moved to Maine the first summer, I made a point of counting the days I needed a fan, one day. Now, in Maine, in the summertime, I need a fan almost every day. Our winters are insane. Yesterday, it was night before last, it was minus 9 here. Today, it's 49 degrees. And the snow, the little snow we have, is melting quickly.
Yeah, we've had an incredibly warm winter, very mild here in the Twin Cities.
So
last year we had a really cold one.
I think if you just pay attention to your own place, you see what I consider our Mother Earth in toxic shock. Her body is in toxic shock, and she's thrashing about, thrashing back and forth. One day it's hot, one day it's cold. You know, it's crazy. The weather patterns are all crazy. I do a lot of traveling, and everywhere I go, people tell me, usually I don't even have to ask. They just tell me, it's one of the first things they say to me, you know, our weather here has been so crazy the last few years. It's just so erratic. All the normal patterns are gone. And that's the way I see it. So we either deal with that now, quickly, convert the military-industrial complex, build rail, build solar, build wind power, tidal power, energy conservation. We either, all of which creates more jobs. The definitive studies by UMass Amherst, Economics Department, Definitive studies say you get more jobs when you do that. Military spending is the least.
Exactly, yes.
It creates the least jobs per, you know, $1 billion of investment.
And
I've heard that. We either make that conversion now and in a small way begin to deal with the edges of this climate change thing, or we do nothing as we're doing now, and we're going down. We're going down hard. And you can forget about going to Mars. You can forget about going to all these other planets because we won't live long enough to get there. And see, we don't have time. We don't have time to move our civilization to Mars. We don't have time to do it. We're going to go down hard here now because we're not dealing with our present situation on our present spinning little satellite orb in space.
Okay. Well, I appreciate you coming onto the show, and I will definitely have your information up on the site. And thank you so much, and I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you very much, Sarah. I really enjoyed it. Appreciate it.
Well, I hope you all enjoyed that wonderful interview with Bruce. I think there's a lot to learn about what's really going on with our military and with space and things. I know everyone has a different political view and a different view on geopolitics, but one thing that everyone should hopefully agree on is that you should educate yourself and understand what's going on and then make a decision politically on what makes the most sense to you. But without education, without some more transparency, it's very difficult for us to make good decisions on behalf of our tax dollars and how we want our country to represent us in the world. So for now, I hope everyone has an absolute wonderful day.
You've been listening to Business Game Changers with host Sarah Westall. Tune in each Monday at noon Pacific, 3 Eastern, as Sarah brings you leading experts, visionaries, and newsmakers who provide the best commentary on big issues and cutting-edge innovations. Sarah's 20 years as a business executive will help you think like an entrepreneur with expertise, energy, and attitude. Tune in Mondays at 12 noon Pacific Time and learn more about Sarah at sarahwestall.com today.